Thank you. I am Willie, and I am an alcoholic. And yes, Stu, all the repairs were made, and everything was in good shape, and Alicia hit. At least we were fortunate enough. We had gotten the tree out of the living room. We had gotten the tree out of the pool. And then when Alicia hit, we had a tree on the garage. So I decided that if anything happened right before this seminar was to take place, I was going to do one of two things. I was either just going to leave the country completely and go to Russia where my husband was when the tornado took place and hide there. Good place to hide. Or else I would just want to flat come on to Florida and ignore the whole thing and leave the whole mess this time for him to clean up when he got home. It's real good to be back in Pompano for this fall seminar. It's good to see the faces that were here last time and to see all the new ones. Just for my own benefit, how many people do we have here in this room this morning with less than a year of sobriety? Oh, beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. How about the ones with less than 6 months? Good. I think this will give us all an idea of what's in this room and the scope we have to contend with and think about. How many people do we have with more than 10 years? Okay, great. How about more than 20? Okay. To me, this is one of the beautiful, glorious things about this seminar that I found out last time. You know, I did come in here not really knowing, being it was the first one, exactly what we were going to do. And Joe and Charlie had been doing their thing for quite a while, but this was the first time that the steps had ever been worked in. And so we didn't know exactly how we were going to do this. And when I got here and really realized the different people that were attending this seminar, those that had just come onto the program, those that had been here for a while, those that had been here for a long time, and to know that we were all here in this room interested in reading and studying this big book. It's a fascinating thing to think about. This whole program is. My job basically this morning is step one. I have not found it necessary to have a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. And for this, dear God, you know, they accuse us Texans of bragging a little bit. It's unkind of them when they do that to us. But we have a fella in San Antonio that has started this little thing about Texans giving their sobriety date, and it's become a joke all over the world. Because we're the only ones really that sort of consistently do this. But we have a beautiful man from San Antonio, and he told us a long time ago, said, you know, when you don't give your sobriety date, I start wondering whether you have one or not. But it has a deeper meaning to those of us that are in the program and that are trying to make this program a part of our lives. It's the only track record we have. You know, we don't have any statistics. Everybody else puts out statistics on their program. 90% of the people that have gone through our program have remained sober. 42% have gone back to drinking. This, that, and the other percent. Alcoholics Anonymous, the only record we have of what this program can accomplish in your life is what it has accomplished in our lives. So that's why I want you to know that for over 25 years. This program has worked in my life. Now, every one of you sitting out there know that for 25 years, there's been a lot of stuff happened to Willie. A lot of things, a lot of living has taken place. I am not what you would call a shy, retiring violet. I'm in there mixing it up with folks. In all sorts of areas. As you will probably know, and those of you that have heard my tapes, I'm a motorcycle rider. I'm a torturer of husbands. I'm all sorts of things to all sorts of people. But I live a lot. And that's what this program has allowed me to do. But there has been a lot that has happened to me, besides tornadoes and hurricanes and things like this. Trauma in my life. Tragedy, heartache, and grief, and sorrow. And yet, due to this program and the people that have supported me in this program for 25 years and 26 now, I have not had to have a drink of alcohol. And you notice I said I did not have to have it. We're going to talk about this step one because I had problems with this step one. Lots of problems. I came into this program 30 years ago. I was not a swift learner. I had a lot of stumbling blocks in my way. And this part of our program is a sharing. I want you, as I go through my step one, I want you to go through yours. Charlie and Joe are covering beautifully what our book says about step one. How Dr. Silkworth explains to us what is wrong. But I want you, as I tell you a little bit about the stumbling blocks to my being able to take this step one, I want you to think about some of the stumbling blocks that maybe you had or perhaps that you're having now. Because I have been told in Alcoholics Anonymous by people a lot wiser and have been in the program a lot longer that, you know, when we hear about somebody with 15, 20 years of sobriety, 8, 9, 25, going back to drinking, we're absolutely sometimes astounded. And I always hear, well, you know, they quit going to meetings. And a very wise man told me one time, said, no, Willie, I don't believe that's all there is to it. They quit doing a lot of things besides going to meetings. And he said, I doubt very seriously. I have a lot of doubt in my mind as to whether they have ever completely taken step one or whether they fool themselves in taking it and then going on with the rest of the program. And then there came that day in their lives and they're living and they're getting out there and mixing it up with other folks that they needed that step one desperately and it wasn't quite all there. It says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. That's two statements. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Dash. That our lives had become unmanageable. When I first came to you, I was very willing to mouth the fact because you seemed to want me to so much. For a while, I wouldn't say the word because it was synonymous with any four-letter word I had ever known. Alcoholic. Or admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and calling myself an alcoholic. But you seemed to want me to, and it seemed to be standing in the way. So I went around mouthing the fact that my name is Willie and I am an alcoholic. But, you know, I was admitting to something that I didn't even understand. It's sort of like, you know, when you go to a doctor, you're not feeling well. Things are not doing so fine. And you go to the doctor, and he gives you a bunch of tests. And then he tells you, after the tests have all been run and they get back, he says, you know, you have blah, blah, blah. And it takes about 18 letters to spell it. Okay? You know, you're not likely to just say, okay, doc, fine, thank you, write him a check and leave. You ask a whole bunch of questions, don't you? Where'd I get it? Did I catch it someplace? Nowadays, that's the first thing we ask. Did I catch it someplace? Is it inherited? You ask that, you pick that doctor's brain because you have something wrong with you that's got you off center and you're not feeling well. Well, with alcoholism, you know, you're not feeling well physically and you're, you know, half crazy. But you don't just go ahead and take a simple explanation, or a complicated one rather, from that doctor. You say, tell me, doctor, in words that, in terms that I can understand, what is wrong with me? What do I do about it? You find out everything you possibly can. And yet when I came to you and you told me I was alcoholic, or at least you were willing to admit after I talked a little while to you that I did have a drinking problem, because I shied away from the word alcoholic so much. I didn't ask you a lot of questions. I really didn't. I didn't read your book. I thought, you know, now, I was one of these that was so intelligent when I got to you. Oh, my God. I was drenched in intelligentsia. I had a couple of degrees hanging on the wall, and I thought, and you're going to give me a book that's going to explain, you know, why my life is in an uproar. So I didn't read your book. And then when I finally consented to glance through it, it hadn't been too long since I had taken a speed reading course myself, so I sped read it. I didn't pay too much attention to the doctor's opinion because, see, I already had a lot of preconceived notions about alcoholism and about an alcoholic. And I was firmly convinced, and you weren't going to, you know, shake me up with a bunch of facts about the fact that alcoholism meant weakness of character. It meant lack of willpower. To me, alcoholism was a defeating word, mentally. And yet, in the very beginning of the book, there was a doctor talking. Didn't pay him any mind. I didn't really read what he had to say, where he was telling me that alcoholism affected two areas, my physical area and my mental area. I didn't try to understand as I would have if I'd have gone to an MD about another problem, physical problem, that yes, this was a twofold disease. You know, we have all the questions, and the questions were even more prevalent, I think, back then. Well, I don't guess so, but there were questions for me to answer, and I answered their questions. And I really, at this period of my life, I could rationalize anything. You told me that if I answered, you know, yes to so many questions, then I probably was alcoholic. But see, I rationalized why I'd answered yes. I was sort of like the fellow, you know, that the police jerked out of the burning building and shook him around a little bit and said, now, George, we have absolutely told you over and over again not to smoke in bed. He said, hell, the bed was on fire when I got in it. And this is how good I was at rationalizing. And your questions, I did answer yes. But see, I had a but behind every one of them to clear myself. to make it make sense to myself that I was different. I think this wanting to be different is one of the biggest stumbling blocks I had in my life against step one. Because, see, when I came to you in the beginning 30 years ago, my life was not completely unmanageable. Not even near it. I was having problems in my life. I wasn't willing to admit that they were connected with alcohol. I lived in a drinking world. You know, so many times when we're working with newcomers, we become a little bit impatient sometime when they tell us, yes, that was probably one of your problems, but I'm different. And I have to constantly remind myself of the fact that, Willie, that's exactly how you were. I was different. I would explain to them very carefully, you do not understand. Back in those days, there weren't a lot of women in AA, very few women in AA. The men helped me and finally loved me sober. But I would tell these men, you don't understand. You simply don't understand. I live in a world of alcohol. I had married a United States Air Force officer. And man, service people like to play. And they like to drink. And it was the only world that I knew at that particular time. I had not come from this kind of background. When they would try to, you know, remind me that all of these things came from someplace, I would look back at a perfectly, what I considered then and what I still consider, a perfectly normal childhood. I am not, you know, we were so tempted sometime to try to put our people and put ourselves into the little holes in an egg carton and try to make ourselves fit. And we do not all fit there. We have a whole bunch of folks here this morning. And we all come from different places, different backgrounds, different religions, different upbringings. Some of us big city folks, some of us country girls. We can't throw a blanket over alcoholism. A lot of people are trying to do it now. They're defining us. A lot of the articles you read on the talk shows, they'll say, an alcoholic is. And I always, you know, it amuses me because an alcoholic is. Do you ever see an alcoholic that is anything? They can't categorize us like this. They can't do it. Because as you go along, and if you've been around for a while, you'll know how many different types of people that we have that come through our doors. And it's puzzling sometimes when I do hear the definitions of alcoholics, and they describe us as people that have no feelings of security. That we have always been people that were full of fear. That we were this way, we were that way. They want to make us into a consistent pattern. This is why we drive, you know, psychiatrists out of their banana trees. They'll treat one of us and we're, you know, okay. They have the solution. We're people that are unsure of ourselves, and we always have been, and we've always felt insecure and unloved and all of this. And yes, 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 we have, so many of us are like that. That's true. We couldn't have all the folks we have in AA and have us all alike. So many of us do. We come from extremely tragic backgrounds. We come from insecure childhood. We have been confused people all of our lives. But a wise man once told me, he said, Willie, you know, so many times the personality does bring on the alcoholism. But in just as many cases, the alcoholism brings on the personality. As a child, I had had, and growing up, I had had no reason to lie. Shoot, Spring isn't big enough to hardly have that many people to even make up a good story for. I mean, Spring, Texas is a little town. And before the tornado hit, you know, I used to say that we were so small we didn't even, you know, have one village idiot. We just all took turns. But now stuff does happen in Spring. But when I was growing up, nothing did. I tried to convince the psychiatrist one time that I was alcoholic because I had such a boring childhood. You know, my mother and daddy didn't hate each other. I didn't hate my brother. He didn't hate me. None of the things. And it's true that many of us do come from broken homes and insecure situations. But not all of us. They try to make an alcoholic consistent. There is nothing consistent about an alcoholic, except his inconsistency. And I love the example that I heard one time of, you know, take an old drunk and he'll walk by your house every morning, every single morning at 8 o'clock for 8 years. And one morning you decide you're going to go out and speak to him. Hell, he won't come. That is the only consistent thing about us. But we are different. But we must learn to listen and hear what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are telling us, and to read this book and see what it says. We must not let these differences stand in our way. And when we're working with new people, we have to remember that all of us were not stamped out of a machine. When I came to you, my life was not completely unmanageable. I still had my husband. I was still teaching school. My life was not completely in shambles. And this is what I interpreted this statement to mean. Our lives had become unmanageable. And this was my biggest but. But you don't understand, men. My life is not unmanageable. It is not out of control. And at that time, it wasn't. But what I didn't understand was I was still an alcoholic. And they tried to convince me. The book explains to me that if I keep on drinking, my life will become completely unmanageable. I used the example last time of the fact that this tornado had hit my house. The tree fell through the living room, into the living room. And I explained to the people that this was, you know, really not a piece of decor that I liked. I had, you know, a contemporary home, but I didn't want it to be that contemporary. But that didn't mean that every room in my house was damaged. There were rooms that were left untouched. I had bedrooms that were all right. I had, you know, a den that was all right. The kitchen was all right. But the living room was in shambles. And I like to think that when I first came to you, this was sort of the way it was. And maybe that's the way it is with you. Maybe your whole life isn't coming apart. Maybe just one part of it is in shambles, and the rest is still intact. We are getting, due to the publicity, due to the fact that belonging to AA is not quite the stigma that it used to be, we are getting people with one room damaged and the rest okay. It's up to us to help them with this big book, to help them in this program, and to show them that the same thing will happen to them that would have happened to my house had I not taken care of that one room when I did. Because for those 4 years that I flipped and flapped around and argued with you, there was seepage, just as there was when this tree came down in the living room. The carpet was not wet back in the bedrooms. But if I would have let the wet carpet stay in the portion of the house where the rain was still coming through, there would have been seepage. And pretty soon I would have looked up and the whole house would have been damaged. So I had to start from the place that was damaged and do the repair work quickly to keep the rest of the house from falling apart. This is where I was when I came to you. My life was becoming damaged, but it was not completely unmanageable. Dear God, I wish I could have saved myself so much heartache and so much humiliation if I would have listened when you told me, Willie, alcohol's not through with you yet, honey. If you keep on messing with this stuff, you're going to have it unmanageable. Because sure enough, in 4 years, there wasn't a room in my house. I've heard it said so many times that, you know, we do have so many things in common. And that each one of us, down deep where we live, have this little person way inside that doesn't want to die. That little person fights for survival. And so many times that's what brought us here, wasn't it? Just that one thread that wanted to survive. And even though I argued and fussed and quarreled with you, and if you're arguing and fussing and quarreling, in between all of your yes buts, try to really see what's in this big book. You'll absorb an awful lot this weekend. And then you take your big book and really read it. Study it. You know, I was amused after I finally got around to looking and at this book. I saw that it was the text. And here I had been a teacher since 1944 and loved it. Love teaching, am still doing it. And whenever I tell a bunch of students that this is the text we are going to use this year, I'm telling them and I'm telling myself, this is the book we are going to study. Not leaf through and not speed read. This is the book we're going to study this year to learn this particular subject. So if you want to learn about yourself, you want to learn about the disease you have, this is your text to be studied. If you have been busy with the arguing and the quarreling, maybe a little story that a fellow told me one time will help you or stop you dead in your tracks the next time you start your yes button. Whether you're doing it verbally or whether you're doing it, you know, to yourself under your breath and muttering as you leave a meeting. He said, you know, Willie, one time there was a lion and he found a bull and he ate the bull. And after he had gotten his fill, he stood up, you know, and roared loudly and long. And a hunter came along, heard him roaring, and shot him. Now, the moral of this story is, if you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. Now, the fellow was too nice to say, Willie, shut up and listen. But he told me that little story, and I got the message. I had my feelings hurt. For several days, I had my feelings hurt. But in order to learn, this is what I had practiced and still practicing in a classroom. I tell my students, you know, you're the listener and I'm the talker. You're supposed to be, your job is to listen and my job is to talk. Oh, how I wish I could have learned that in the beginning. Then there wouldn't have been my stumbling blocks that I had to this foundation step, step number one, as on a ladder. And if you start skipping steps on a ladder, you're in big trouble because you're liable to fall, and especially that first one. In our 12 and 12, it says, you know, who cares to admit to complete defeat? Isn't it strange that we come in here arguing and fussing sometime? Because the word alcoholic means defeat. It meant it to me. And who's really anxious to say, I'm a failure? You know, I was in my 20s. What did I want to do, stand up? I'm a complete failure in life. This is not, it's not difficult to realize why our newcomers, why I fought the way I did, and why our newcomers fight us the way they do now. I don't want to become impatient with them when they start in on me. Because it says, who cares to admit defeat? Practically no one. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. If the human race gave up the first time they hit a stumbling block, what kind of you know, we wouldn't stand a chance as a community, as a family, as a nation. If, you know, the first time some trouble came along, we said, okay, that's it. Won't try again. And we have an extra dose of that, of the not giving up. But all humans are the same way, practically. Or most humans. They do not want to admit defeat in any area of their life. Especially in one that has such a downer type thing to go with it. It's truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. No other kind of bankruptcy is like this one. Alcohol now becomes the creditor. Bleeds us of our all self-sufficiency and all will to resist its demands. Once this stark fact is accepted, our bankruptcy as going humans, human concerns, is complete. And when so many of us get here, this simply is not the case yet. We are not completely bankrupt. This is why the sharing goes on. This is why I share with every new woman that walks through our little group doors. On a one-to-one basis, I tell her what alcohol did to me. Everything that I want to forget, I share with her. So that she will know that the humiliation and the degradation as a human being and that a woman drunk goes through is felt by another woman. And that I don't want this to happen to her. And that together, maybe we can keep it from happening. In our 12 and 12, it says, but upon entering AA, we soon take quite another view of this absolute humiliation. We perceive that only through utter defeat we are able to take our first steps toward liberation and strength. I'm on page 21. Our admission of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. To admit complete defeat helps clear the way for victory. You know, a good general knows that. A good general knows when to retreat. He knows when it's wise to take his men and pull them back and regroup. Any human being, when we get to thinking about solving a problem, sometimes we have to back away from that problem, rethink it, pick some brains, go to some experts. Even though we're knee-deep in trying to solve it ourselves, we have to back away from it and say, you know, this is too much for me. I have to have help. I have to talk to some people that have gone through this problem before. Our book uses this example, our big book uses the example of the, you know, the man without a leg. He's not going to grow that leg back. If I were to lose a limb, if I were to lose a leg, and you came walking up to me on your two legs and you says, "Oh, Willie, gosh, honey, you got a lot going for you. You have a lot of things left, so you've lost your leg." I know a lot of people that have lost legs, and they're just doing great. They have artificial limbs now, and they have this and that, and they could give me a big pep talk, and I'd be sitting there thinking, you know, why don't you go someplace and drop dead? How do you know how I feel? I would be so full of resentment with you standing there on your two legs telling me how to operate on one that I would absolutely hate everything you were telling me. But you let a gal come up to me that has lost a leg and say, "Willie, I know this is hard, honey. I know it's hard. It was hard for me in the beginning. And I want to tell you some of the thoughts that I had and share them with you. But I'm going to tell you, too, how I've gone on with my life and the tools I have used to adjust to this." You better believe I'd listen to her. This is what we mean to each other. You know, the name of this organization is Alcoholics Anonymous. The impact of one alcoholic's life upon the life of another alcoholic. Let's don't ever forget that. You know, let's don't ever forget that none of us came in here in a bunch. We came in here one by one. Group everything is fine. We need our groups like we're sharing this morning. We need to get together in bunches. But let's don't get so busy with our bunches. And I'm talking to me too when I say let's us not forget. And let's don't get so busy with our bunches and our groups that we forget about this terribly, terribly important impact that we can have on a one-to-one basis with people. And the impact they can have on us. Last paragraph on 21, it says, "We know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all of its consequences. Until I was willing to accept that all of my life was going to become damaged, I could not take one more step." I grabbed this, you know, when I did get around to looking at the book, I thought, all right, there's a chapter in there, and they keep reading it at all these dumb meetings. How it works. All right, I'll read how it works. Then I'll know what to do. You know, wasn't willing to admit that my life was becoming a shamble. But I was going to fix it. That's sort of like, you know, you walk around with answers to questions you haven't even been asked yet. But see, we had gotten real good at that when we were in our active alcoholism. I had gotten good at it. With the rationalizing and the excuse making and the line. Something I had not had to do prior to my collision with alcohol. And how it deteriorated my life. You know, if alcoholism could move in overnight, maybe it wouldn't be so puzzling. Maybe if it could strike like a snake, it wouldn't be so puzzling. But it doesn't happen that way, does it? It's one piece at a time that we lose. And with us periodics, and there's a lot of us in this room, the majority of women are periodics. Not all, the majority. But periodics have, I think, a lot more trouble. I don't know whether Charlie and Joe will disagree with that, and that's all right. Good disagreement's good for us. But periodics are such a pain. You know, we have more trouble with step one and admitting that our lives are unmanageable. Because, see, we have time in between our spree drinking to fix up and patch up and put back together. We can get stuff pretty well glued back together in between. I always could. Because I was learning how to do this. I'd get myself into, you know, a corner. And then I would stay sober long enough to patch everything up. Get everything, you know, the job would be all right. The husband, I knew what to do with him over a period of time, you know, learned that pretty quick, how to get him back in a good humor. And put the Band-Aids on and have my life just sailing along, you know, fat, dumb, and happy. And then, you know, out of a clear blue sky, and this is usually the way I thought of it, and even my husband would, you know, come in, I would be drinking, and he'd say, "My God, what happened?" Nothing happened. I just was convinced because I had patched up, I had band-aided, I had done all this stuff, life was going along smooth again. So why can't I have a drink or two? Periodics are a pain. A person that drinks every single day doesn't have time to do the patching up, so they deteriorate quickly. And I think there's an advantage there. I often tell them, you know, you're lucky when they come and say, "I drink every single day." I always want to say to myself when I go call on a new gal, you know, when she tells me, "I've been drinking every single day for the last 5 or 6 years." And I say to myself, "Oh, thank goodness." And our book tells us that unless we are willing to admit to the devastating weakness and all of its consequences, we're not going to get very far. Until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. And mine was precarious. Or, of real happiness, he will find none at all. See, the restlessness, the discontent had started to take place even between the drunks. And I couldn't see the connection with alcohol because I didn't know what alcohol was doing to me in even the sober periods of my life. The fact that it had made a liar out of me. And I begun to lie about things that didn't really concern my drinking directly to make myself feel better inside, to make my little person feel better. Because he was beginning to give me some problems and saying, "Willie, this is no way to live. This is no way for a lady to live." Because, see, I thought that, you know, a lady was someone that could get drunk once in a while. And I didn't realize that I had become a drunk that was a lady once in a while. Proved beyond doubt by an immense experience, this is one of the facts of AA. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. And I think just knowing that if you haven't gotten to the point where every area of your life is affected by alcohol, if you think it's not, We have an expression, you know, no one gets here by mistake. Now, nowadays, we have lots of visitors, a lot of folks that have gotten stoned a couple of times, you know, and they have read about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they come and look us over. And then they decide, you know, they're not in that bad a shape, and they go back out, and maybe we never see them again, and everything's all right with them. They don't have the strength to become an alcoholic. But when I see what they're missing in a room like this, I sort of feel sorry for them, even though I don't want them to go through the pain. You know, I'm talking about that we can't put us all in the little hole in the egg carton, and yet we share two basic ingredients, no matter what background we come from, no matter what our experiences are in life. We share pain and loss of control. These are the two things that I look for when I'm talking with a new woman. Does she have that pain in her eyes? And you can spot it. It doesn't take long. The difference between the eyes of a person who is sober and trying to the very best of their ability to live this program, and the eyes of a person who may be sitting here dry, but hating every minute of it. I understand that look because I went through it so long. I was sober and hated every minute of it. I didn't realize that there are three A's in this program. We have to admit first that we're alcoholic. Then we have to accept it. And Joe and Charlie are doing a beautiful job of showing us these three things. Admit it, accept it, and then we have to approve of it. And when I say have to approve of it, if you want it all, if you want everything that this program has to offer, just admitting it and accepting it is not going to be enough to get it all. You may stay sober the rest of your life. But if you're a person that's as greedy as I am, I want it all. I want what Wesley has. I want what the people have in this program that have been sober longer than I have and have that certain something about them that is indescribable. When first challenged to admit defeat, most of us revolted. So if you're new on the program, read what it says. You're not all that different. Because way back then, when the 12 and 12 was written, it says, you know, most of us revolted. None of us. I never have really talked to anybody that came in and we suggested that they may be alcoholic, and they said, good! Gosh dog, I'm glad. Ooh, I've always wanted to be one of those. And I was a little old kid. Somebody asked me what I wanted to be, and I said, I want to be an alcoholic. Not a fireman or a policeman. No. We most of us just didn't take to this like the ducks out there take to that water. So we're not all that unique in our fight. Just don't let the fight consume you. And even if you've been sober a long time, and you've been in and around the program a long time, I like to re-examine my step one. I'm so grateful to be given the opportunity to look at my step one again. And I try to look at it very frequently. I bring it up as often in groups as I possibly can, in my group. Let's talk about step one tonight. Let's don't talk about three or four or five or six tonight. We've been talking about those lately. Let's go back and talk about step one and the unmanageability that was happening in our lives that I don't want anymore. Sometimes I don't manage well in a situation. And with hindsight, I look back at it and I think, well, I screwed that up. A lot of times. You can't be out there with those folks in all sorts of situations and not mess something up once in a while. But see, it's all right now for me to not manage well in situation. It's okay. Because it's me. It's not the alcohol inside me that's consuming me, that's making me less than a person. What I'm doing is making a human mistake. Just a plain human error. And you know, I'd sure rather be making human errors and making mistakes than being where a lot of folks are. You know, every time I pass by a cemetery, I think, you know, nobody out there is making a mistake. I would rather go ahead and make my mistakes. My program gives me a step that says, you know, all I have to do is admit I'm wrong. And really admit it. And try to do what I can to repair the damage. So my program takes care of my human mistakes. But I don't want to be back out there where my life is in shambles again. In a long, long ago, in looking back, and it seems like it's such a short time, and yet, in terms of years, I'm sponsoring a little girl now. I was at a meeting the other night, and 15 people called me to tell me about this. I don't know why they take that. People, you know, try to get to me once in a while, because it's not real easy to do. So I think they really take it as a challenge. But they called me to tell me that this little new girl I was sponsoring was being told something at a meeting over and over again by a very forceful lady. And she didn't quite, you know, understand, because I had told her something different. So she sat there very quietly, very shy little girl. And she sat there for a while, and then she said, "But my sponsor told me such and so and so and so." And the lady said, "Your sponsor is wrong." Well, the little girl sat there a few more minutes, and she said, "Well, she's been sober longer than I've been born. So I'm going to do what my sponsor tells me." And like I say, a lot of people delighted in calling me and telling me she'd said that, because that does set you back a little bit when they tell you, "You've been sober longer than I've been born." It sort of puts you back, you know, where you belong in the age bracket, that's for sure. If you're having any ideas that young, you know, that you're getting any younger, no, that'll take it out of you real quick. But it's a good feeling. So in that respect, yes, it's been a long time. But when I look into the eyes of a newcomer, and when I see that hurt and that humiliation, it hasn't been that long. I don't want to ever forget it. Because if I do, I'm of no use to the new gal. None. If I get way up there, you know, and am so heavenly pure that I become no damn earthly good, then I can't help anybody. See, I can't walk on the water. Every time I put my foot out, I just right to the bottom. I have to swim like crazy. So I hope I never get to the point where I don't understand what they're talking about when they start giving me the yes buts and I'm different. I want to understand that they may have some good valid points, and that my days of listening are not over either. That I must listen to that newcomer and help them and guide them the best that I can to not fall over the same stumbling blocks that I did by telling her about my stumbling blocks. And maybe I can save her just a little more pain than she will have to have, than is necessary for her to have, if I can just share a little bit with her and keep her a little bit safer. It's more dangerous to drink nowadays than it was when I came in. God, there's so much more going on out there. Everywhere. And, Lord, you hardly stand a fighting chance if you have all your facilities. If you're thinking clear as a crystal bell, you know, they're coming out of the woodwork at us. They're aiming at us on the freeways. Everything. And to have all of your facilities nowadays is going to keep you alive longer. I mean alive. And that's what I want to be, because I'm having fun. And I want to stay that alive as long as I can. But I want to stay this way. You know, there's a lot of difference in being alive and just living. A lot of difference. And I want it all. Now, I would like at this time for y'all to go to the mic back here. And if you have a question about step one, don't feel that any question that you might ask, you're not asking a bunch of experts that's going to give you an answer. We will share with you, not me, but I will call on someone to share with you, or let those that want to share their answer. And, you know, we don't get sober with just one answer from one person. We get sober by putting a lot of answers together. So if you have a question, don't think that I'll sound dumb. Don't worry about that, hon. We've all been through that dumb period. Some of us still in it. So if you have a question or a comment about your step one, a stumbling block that you would like to share that will maybe keep somebody else from falling into that trap, then let's do it at this time. The mic is right back here. Do I have a volunteer?